This is Rafflebix After Hours.
Congratulations for clicking on the correct podcast, and welcome to Rack Addicts After Hours, a music and technology show. My name is Ben, Pete is here with me, and of course, tech, zik, and musicology will happen, maybe. First, Pete, what have you been doing this last week?
Well, a couple of things. Firstly, as I predicted last week, I've had a good fondle of the Micro Freak.
Naughty. Oh, wait, the new one, the big one.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say that big. Still,
oh, is it still quite... I haven't
yeah,
met one.
I mean, you could easily slip it into a largish rucksack.
It's not the Micro Freak, though, is it? What's it called? I've forgotten.
It's the Mini Freak.
Mini Freak? Ooh, why have I forgotten? Yeah, it's the Mini Freak. That doesn't sound right. The Archeria Mini Freak, anyway.
Yes. So, as we predicted, the keyboard very much seems to be the Keystep 37 mm-hmm. keybed.
It's only marginally better than the ones from the Korg. What are they called?
Ooh.
I'm glad I can't remember what they're called because they're awful. Know that thing with the vocoder that everybody seems to love but me?
Yeah, I know the one you mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Micro Korg.
Yeah, that's the one.
Ugh, those are the worst.
Well, people seem to like them for some reason.
Yeah, we'll not talk about them. The Mini Freak.
Yes.
In terms of sound, feel maybe not, but sound.
Sound, it was very interesting. Mm. There is a lot of interesting and quite a massive range of sounds and soundscapes in the machine.
Excellent. How were the presets?
They were okay. They seem to be rich and interesting, textured. There's certainly a lot of features. I mean, as with a lot of Arturia stuff, technically it's an interesting instrument. But as I said last week, if they could only have put a full-size keybed in there, it would be certainly warrant the price they're selling it for. In fact, I would imagine they could most probably charge a little bit more.
Mm. What about if we think, unfortunately, in the Roland direction? Is it the right size to be treated like the Jupiter XM? It's actually a module, but it just happens to have a keyboard attached if you can't be bothered to hook up the MIDI.
No, it's not really. It's
a weird mid-size.
Yeah, it's. I wouldn't say it's wider, but it's certainly narrower.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the construction's still quite solid. Arturia stuff tends to be built like a tank.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit plasticky on top. The keyboard kind of lets it down. If they'd gone for something that was more physically the size of the original Hydrosynth.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because that's a small keybed, isn't it? But it's still tidy, portable.
Yes.
And I guess the Mini Freak would have been a lot flatter.
Yes, definitely. It's a lot slimmer. I definitely think they've kind of designed it to be ultra-portable.
You
throw it in the bag and take it with you and have it on an aeroplane, possibly.
Yeah.
That type of thing. I'm not sure if it's got... don't think it's got battery power, but you I suppose you could have some sort of power pack that you could power it up.
Do like a MyVolts thing off a USB power bank, maybe.
I can see that it is a natural progression from the Micro Freak, but yeah, they just could have just done that little bit of extra. But maybe they intend to have a full-size one at some stage, and this is just a halfway point.
Yeah, when I've been reading forum threads and the other reviews and watching videos, most of the comments seem to be, I'll wait for the Matrix Freak, which, to be fair, that would be an amazing machine.
Yes, but I'm thinking at the best part of £600, I don't necessarily see them flying off the shelves.
It's certainly not niche. That's not the word I want. I suppose it's off the beaten synth track, in a way. It's just a little bit out there.
Possibly. But also, the potentiality for it losing a lot of value very quickly once you've purchased one. If you go by how much a Micro Freak cost new currently and how much they're going for second hand, there's quite a divide.
Let's get those numbers. So regular retail, we're looking at 288 and 319, somewhere in that region. Let's have a look on the Reverb. Where's the... how do I find sold ones? All filters, sold listings. 220, 225. Ooh, interesting, they seem to have separated the keyboard and the control panel. That's a bit weird. 220, 160, somebody got a steal there.
Yes.
210.
My colleague at work...
the 150
sold,
off.
Yeah, sold his for, I think, 140 he got for his.
Not bad. So, wait, no, that's bad for him.
Yes.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is that secondhand, if you're careful, you can get one half the price of a new retail one.
Yeah, I said 150 off. It's totally not. It's still 100. 100-ish.
Yeah.
Not too shabby. Yeah, that 160 on Reverb, that's great. Not bad. I forgot they did a white one.
Yeah, that was the special, wasn't it, with the microphone?
Yeah, and then they added it to the original anyway, so it's just a bit odd. Oh, well.
There you go. And apparently you can use earbuds, you know, the sort of phone earbuds that have got the mic built in.
That's kind of neat.
It'll do exactly the same.
Yeah, because it's not like you need a good microphone for it. That's
not really, because it's a very robotic vocoder, so it's not like you need crystal clear vocals going in.
Not too bad. Any more tales of your
week? The gas is extended, but in a different direction. I'm gearing up to get a 50mm 1.2 prime Canon.
Camera stuff.
So,
So the Nifty 50. Yeah.
Yes.
1.2, nice and fast.
Yes. So I've been doing the usual trick. I'm sure many people do this when you're just about to make a purchase. You go and watch lots of YouTube videos about it just to reaffirm whether it's actually what you want.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of opinions. I think that the main opinion, it's a bokeh beast.
Oh, yeah. That's what people want these days.
But apparently, when you've got it set at 1.2, it's not overly sharp.
Yeah, I mean, that's just how lenses go. That's something that's frustrated me a bit with my film stuff, is when it gets a bit too dark and you have to open up the lens all the way, it just, everything's way too soft.
But apparently that's what people want from it. They want that kind of, there's a certain sort of softness with the bokeh, gives you those kind of dreamy
certainly
sort
for
of
the
pictures.
Yeah, like the background separation and all that. But when your subject is also a bit squishy, at least that's what happens for my experience. Maybe I'm just missing my focus all the time, which is very possible.
Apparently with film, if you're using film stock and that lens, which apparently you can do,
yeah, just an adapter or something,
it's not so problematic because of the grain of the film.
That's a good point.
But when you're using a full frame,
you'll see
digital
it.
And it's high pixel rate, you see the softness. But I'm convinced it's what I want, and it will kind of complement the lenses I've got already.
Nice one.
I keep telling myself, no, that's it, that's the full set of lenses, I'm not going to get any more, and then there's always something.
You'll get one of those probe macro lenses.
I have thought about one, so those really long sort of,
with the waterproof end.
Yes,
and dip and dip and
poke it in places.
Yeah.
What are they, snorkel lenses or something like
that? There's some kind of name like that. I've seen some really good kind of commercial use on YouTube. I mean, like advert, TV advert type stuff where they'll, I think there's a really good one which was like making a pizza type thing for a commercial, just flying really low over the things. It looks like you're a miniaturized helicopter flying over pizza toppings. It's cool.
Yeah, I've seen sort of shots when they've kind of reversed on a slider
coming
out of something, and you're emanating from somewhere where you wouldn't expect to be.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's often that kind of video, and then in the recommended it'll be really interesting motion control with those giant robot arms and stuff. That's really interesting.
I do appreciate those sort of videos, and the technicality of how they make them as well is
definitely
always very interesting. No, I haven't really, I have flirted with the thought of getting sort of an unusual lens. I mean, I had thought about getting a tilt shift lens at one stage. But there's only so many kind of cityscape type of videos that you can possibly make. There's already thousands on the internet, so why make any more? But yeah, so that's it. So hopefully I will be getting a secondhand one. The new price is eye-watering.
How eye-watering?
I think sort of best part of 1,700 in the UK, whereas I can get a second-hand one from a reliable retailer, that which comes with a six-month warranty and states, well, I've got the particular retailer that I'm thinking of has got 32 second-hand 50mm lenses in stock, and the most expensive ones, which are just over £800, are rated as like-new condition.
That's a pretty good discount.
Yeah, they have several kind of, they've got like-new, excellent, and then some use, so they're graded like a lot of that type of equipment. So I'm focusing on the like new section.
Of course.
And the fact you get a 6 month warranty as well. So it gives me a lot more security than possibly buying from a member of the public. Not that I'm averse from that, but just having that extra sort of thought that there is a warranty with it.
Absolutely.
But other than that, that's been my week.
Nice one. Well, let's continue the photography thing, because I do have two rolls of film back from my trip to Copenhagen, and I think the colour one had a bit of Oxford in it as well. Interestingly, how did I describe it? I sent a message to my dad, because he's my photography bible most of the time when WhatsApp opens. Yeah, so obviously going through the scans that came back, my favourite ones, well, I don't think it was necessarily my favourite ones, but the shots that actually came out and I think are good, they all tend to follow a bit of a sort of minimal negative space, kind of limited texture type situation. Let me show them to you, Pete, and you can see what I mean. I've definitely got a few of these from other roles of film as well, this kind of thing. But it's exciting for me because it seems to suggest that some kind of eye for a certain sub-photography genre thing seems to be brewing, and I'm quite excited by it. So here we are. There's one.
I see. So more architecture. Seems to be a theme here. Is it the theme you're talking about, or...?
Architecture, kind of, but it's more... I'm talking more in the composition with this particular thing, so...
Or sort of angular sky.
Yeah, it's all the big open expanse next to the rest of the subject, or just interesting textures and colours in big blocks.
Interesting framing as well.
Yeah.
There's nothing like that. This is a double door in a building. There's nothing like a door photograph.
I do like a good old door. But yeah, I'm interested to... with film, because there's such a wait between remembering what you took and then it coming back and you seeing it, it's kind of, ooh, I didn't know I was thinking about that at the time. Or it's kind of like, I didn't know I was aiming for a particular style, but a style appears to be emerging on its own, which is quite interesting, and I'm excited by it.
Mm. So do you think you're going to continue in this direction with these type of photographs?
I wonder if I try and take those photos, if it will backfire horribly, but we'll find out. We'll find out. So that's been cool. Another thing, I was at my parents' a while ago for my birthday, and I brought a certain jacket with me. Remember, we were talking about jackets a while ago, and you had that incredibly heavy motorcycle jacket.
Yeah, the Vanson leather.
Yeah, that's the one. So mine isn't heavy, and it's not, I guess it's styled a bit motorcycly, but it's made by Sparco, who I think do a lot of racing related stuff, like those sort of racing onesie suit things designed to keep all your body parts together and hopefully not on fire if you crash. Yeah, they make that kind of stuff, and they do casual clothing. This one doesn't appear to exist anymore, and it was a gift. Really like the style, but it made me look a bit round, and the sleeves were kind of too fat. But it was really, really waterproof, really nice and warm, and I thought the style was really good, and that had sort of inspired me. It's like, oh, I think I know what kind of jacket I would like. So, and I'd been searching probably for about a year, and just never found the right thing at all. So the solution was, let's go get it tailored. So I did that near the parents. My mum found a reputable tailor, and yeah, I had an interesting experience standing there having pins put in this jacket, and it is finished, but I can't tell you how it fits because I don't have it yet. But I'm very excited. The tailoring experience was new and exciting.
Certainly something I haven't experienced ever.
Yeah, and obviously wasn't there to see the craft being done, but obviously the measuring part is part and parcel of the experience. And that was cool. The guy really exuded confidence in what he was doing. It was brilliant. And yeah, ooh, I'm so excited. It's cool.
Sounds like the thing that we talk about a lot, which is watching someone who's mm-hmm. very skilled at what they're doing, and they do it effortlessly, and you have complete confidence in whatever they're doing.
Yeah. A little bit of a tangent here. You know when you're getting a haircut?
Yes.
And the hairdresser will do the thing where they kind of use two fingers to kind of just grab a bit of your hair, and then they'll kind of scissor over the top. Obviously, it depends on how you have your hair cut, if this is a thing that happens to you. They'll just kind of grab a bit, sort of pull it upwards a little bit to find the right length, and then chop over the top. Does that happen to you?
Yeah, certainly when they're doing the top part.
Exactly. Yeah, so he kind of, the way that he sort of went to adjust the sleeves had a little bit of that, this is so hard to describe. When he was doing the sleeves, the way he was sort of grabbing it to get the right circumference had the same feeling of muscle memory of when a barber is doing the hair thing I just attempted to describe.
So something he's done hundreds, Oodles. If not thousands of times over and over.
I felt I was in good hands. The worry was, when we were looking for the right place to take this jacket, is, you know, it'd be a place that is actually a dry cleaners that does adjustments as well, and it's kind of, they'll turn up some trousers and probably get it right, but we didn't really know how to find somebody that was, you know, a proper tailor. But we did, so that's cool.
Excellent. There can't be that many about.
No, I don't think so. Well, I mean, I was near Stratford-upon-Avon to get that one done.
Yeah,
so
certainly not Savile Row, then.
No, definitely not. Yeah. It's far too warm, actually, at the moment, which we didn't expect. But once it's cold enough, that'll be in regular rotation. So I'll be able to see how it went.
You can show it off to us.
I can model it for you. Do a little twirl.
Yeah.
Here's a thing. more along the corner of excellence and ability and down the avenue of the orators and voiceovery type people that we like, I've been listening to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy again and Restaurant at the End of the Universe. Not again, because I haven't actually finished it before. Hitchhiker's Guide, on Audible at least, is read by Stephen Fry, and Restaurant at the End of the Universe is read, on Audible again, by Martin Freeman, who I think was in the film as well as Arthur Dent.
Yes, he was.
And great, great actor. Might not be your favourite. I happen to like him. I think he's got a great voice. And then going from Hitchhiker's Guide to Restaurant, I didn't realise how good Stephen Fry was. It's just with that comparison, I'm so sorry, Martin Freeman. You're amazing, and I love you. But Stephen Fry, he's good.
Stephen Fry actually did the voice of the book in the film that Martin Freeman was playing Arthur Dent in.
He did indeed, with the sort of the narrations of the dolphins leaving a few seconds before the Vogons destroyed the Earth and all that kind of stuff. Ooh, yeah. Spoilers.
Thank you for all the fish.
Exactly. There were good bits about the film overall. Yeah.
I thought they did quite well. I'm old enough to remember the original radio series. Mm. And the original TV adaptation of it.
Yeah, I've only heard the radio series. I didn't see the TV version.
I believe it was some of the same actors, possibly.
Oh, yeah. Hmm.
But it was an awfully long time ago.
Yeah, obviously I wasn't there, but I have the... I think I have it on iTunes or something. Yeah, I didn't have anything technical to add. I was just really, really enjoying appreciating Stephen Fry, as we do.
That's why he's regarded as a bit of a national treasure.
Absolutely. Moving into a more musical direction, because we have done some technology, but musical. I've done a musical thing, vaguely. So, do you know any Steve Reich?
I don't know any Steve Reich.
I can't say that I know more than two things. But I was on the Lines forum the other day, and somebody was demonstrating a bit of code they'd made for monome norns, and they used the melody from Piano Phase for it. I thought, why not? I'll just make my own Piano Phase. So, this piece, Piano Phase, is, as I explained to you earlier, Pete, it's just a really, really short bit of music. On your manuscript, it's a bar, I think, with 12 notes. I think it's 12. And it's just a repeated melody. It is designed for two piano players to play simultaneously at very, very slightly different tempos. So they gradually drift apart and you get some interesting doobries happening.
Well, I can imagine the notes will start cascading over each other.
Exactly, and it's super cool. There are multiple performances on YouTube which I urge you to go and see, including one guy playing it himself, which is just insane.
Both parts.
Both parts himself. No idea how. I think, to my mind, the easiest way to do it was just to give them a click track, each separate ones, and just play it. I think that would be considered cheating in the circles that do it, so these are really excellent musicians. It's relatively fast, but obviously it's just one repeating pattern, but it's magical to watch. So I made it in MIDI just to experiment with it. Here it is. I'll skip through because I'm not going to subject you to 13 odd minutes of it. This is the start. I'll give you some more volume, actually. Do that again. And so on. I'll skip through again. You do get some interesting artifacts when you create it using samples. So I do things like pan them and EQ them slightly differently so it's less weird and you get a bit of comb filtering early on. But it's magical. It's more interesting if you do sit through the whole thing because your mind also kind of plays tricks on you a little bit as well in terms of the notes that your ears grab. And it is fascinating. What a piece.
How long is the full performance if you had two pianists performing it as it should be?
Yeah, it depends on their starting tempo, of course. But yeah, sort of 15 minutes, something like that.
So is it kind of a bit of a transcendental kind of experience? You're supposed to just sort of go with it.
Yeah, it's really cool. The one I saw was, actually, if you just search Piano Phase, it'll be the top result on YouTube, Reich Piano Phase. That one's 18 minutes. And then, yeah, Piano Phase, in brackets, solo, is the one. That was 14 and a half minutes. No, nearly 16 minutes. Yeah, I do love it. This was something we covered a lot in the experimental music and sound modules when I was at uni, and one of my favourite ones then. Right, weekly updates, updated weekly. We do have some news. Firstly, Moog have released the Moogafoogers, I don't know which sounds better, they both sound weird, the pedals as effects plugins, being the first of Moog's plugin-only offerings, if you exclude the iOS apps.
I did see this. People were looking at interesting ways to connect them up, virtually, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, they had a bit of a cult following, I think. Lots of people kind of going for the full set. So, yeah, all seven of the sort of last batch that was in production are available, I believe. So that is low-pass filter, ring modulator, 12-stage phaser, analog delay, the MRF, which is a resonant filter pattern generatory type situation, the Freakbox, which is synced VCO envelope modulation-y type stuff, and then you have a chorus flangey vibrato thing called Cluster Flux.
Yeah, they were very popular. They were very expensive as well.
Yeah, I don't really remember them being available when I first started at the shop, but what kind of price do you remember?
I think they were in the realms of £400 each.
That was probably before there were a lot of pedals hitting £400-£500.
Yes, and you rarely see them going secondhand these days.
I'm just about to hit up the eBay, see what we've got. Ooh, a starting price of £550. Yeah. Here, let's have a look at the sold listings. Where's the button? One didn't go at £1,100. Oh, interesting. It looks like they're niche enough that they're really struggling to sell them. So there's lots that just didn't go around the £500-£600. We've got one here, £950, that went.
It depends which model.
Yeah, so analog delay, £950. Analog delay, £860. Ring modulator, £408. Low pass filter, £410. Ring modulator, £350. Most broadly applicable in the guitar pedal format, that would make sense that the delay would be the most popular. £950, £860. One didn't go at nearly £1,700. Mad.
Even though they were sort of floor based, I suppose you could call them sort of guitar pedal.
I mean, they've got the stomp buttons on them.
Yeah, exactly. But Moog made a rack that you could have three of them mounted in a 19-inch rack enclosure.
Yeah, I remember seeing that in many iterations of Deadmau5's studio.
Yes.
So there we go. If you were a fan and you really don't want to shell out for the real deal, plugins for you. So it's all seven, a limited introductory price of $149, going up to $249 whenever this introductory thing ends. Not a terrible price, I reckon, for a plugin.
How much was that again?
$149 for all seven.
Doesn't seem too bad.
No, again, niche.
Yes, still doesn't quite beat the hardware, though.
No, and I guess we've spoken in previous COD pasts about, actually, now I'm thinking about it, a previous podcast is a COD past. Anyway. They've been kind of struggling to some degree with their business, and not having to ship a product is probably a good thing to have on their roster.
Yeah, I suppose so. Your virtual products, you can just multiply them. Once they're designed and coded, they're just ready to go, aren't they?
You'll just have to have kind of updates, that kind of team of bug fixing and stuff. But in terms of the cost involved with shipping and handling, it should be relatively light, though. I suppose development is not cheap.
I wonder if they did those plugins directly themselves, or a third party did them and they just licensed the wherewithal, the branding.
Who knows? I couldn't find out. Here's one, talking about key steps and such earlier. Akai have overlapped somewhat with an interesting offering. It's one of the MPK Mini range, the MPK Mini Plus. Of course, the MPK Mini was one of our favourites to flog to new students at the local college and people starting out music production, because it's cheap, cheerful, and it worked as a MIDI controller. But now we have more keys on this one. It's a bit wider. We've got 8 encoders as well as the 8 pads, pitch mod, joystick, and a little screen doing some stuff. But excitingly for us synth nerds, DIN MIDI in and out, clock in and out, pitch, gate, mod, CV, as well as a sustain input. So I think they're wanting a slice of that key step high.
As so many manufacturers do now.
Yes, indeed. So we do have, I believe, let me just verify this, you have a step or live sequencer. So that's 8 notes of polyphony per step and 16 notes per drum step if you're using a drum track. Arpeggiator on there as well, with scales, should you want them, and the 8 potentiometers transmit MIDI CCs. So it looks like they're going for the Keystep 37 corner of the world, because that has that assignable MIDI stuff on it.
Yep, sounds like it.
Indeed. So that's going to be a USB-B, a big old square port on the back. Let's get the price. €199. What's the Keystep 37? €179. I think the Akai might be smaller, just in terms of its physicality. That's a tricky one.
Yes, the original is only, I want to say, about £85.
The MPK?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was certainly 60 or 60-something when I was selling them. $74.50 now. Yeah, $79 for the all black.
Or there's the white one.
Oh,
there's four, I believe.
Yes,
different colours.
We've got the white one with the black
keys,
natural keys. $73. Oh, there's a grey one, normal one, all black. Yeah, four. And then there's the MPK Mini Play, which I thought was a really cool idea. Not well received or that exciting, really, but just putting a sound engine in it. So if you've got your little music production setup, you can't be bothered to fire up a virtual instrument. You can just quickly plug in a headphones, get a piano or a synth sound just to work out a melody or something. I think that's nice.
And it's not that much more expensive than the standard one.
About £30. Yeah. Kind of it. Not too terrible. Anyway, keyboards, shmeeboards. I am going to talk about studio monitors, I think, for possibly the first time on this show. Have we done anything studio monitory before?
I don't believe we have.
I don't know why. It's interesting because we're both Genelec people.
Yes.
We have our Genelecs and we like them, so we don't care anymore. Yeah, maybe that's where we've got to.
I don't spend much time contemplating studio monitors other than when I'm discussing them with customers.
Yeah. No, I definitely haven't since leaving the shop. Huh. Anyway, so I have the 8020s. What were yours, 8050s?
I have got a pair of 8350s.
Ooh, the big ones and the smart ones.
Yes.
Not bad, not bad. Well, it's the smart ones that we're going to compare these to. So Adam Audio have refreshed the A-Series. You seen these? You must have seen these. Well, maybe not in the shop, but heard of them.
Yeah, I think we might have them if they're the new DSP Adams.
Those are the ones, absolutely. So they've partnered with a company that I do quite like because I use their software, SonarWorks. Ooh, is that because Focusrite bought them? Are Adam part of the Focusrite Innovation thing? I need to look this up. I think they might be. Somebody owns Adam. Who owns Adam?
Well, as long as it's not Behringer.
No, it's all good. I think, Focusrite Group. And what about SonarWorks? Okay, no. So it doesn't look like, as I suspected, that Focusrite Innovation own SonarWorks, so it's just a really cool collaboration. So SonarWorks Reference 4 is a room calibration software and headphone calibration stuff, which I think is excellent. But that technology is now in DSP form in these Adam monitors. So many, many times less latency should you want to use that. They're giving you 60 days of trial. Then, thankfully, it's not a subscription. You just buy a license and you need to buy the microphone, of course. Get your measurement done of your room, and that's great. So not quite as smart as the Genelec SAM system, because with the GLM, the Genelec Loudspeaker Manager, you can do surround sound stuff and correct surround sound stuff, if I'm right, which is mad.
Certainly with GLM 4 you can. Mm. I would imagine you can with GLM 3 as well.
Yeah, so if you have shallower pockets than the lucky people who can afford that kind of rig, Adam's going to get you slightly closer there. So they've revamped the offering a little bit. It used to be, this is the AX series, it would be 3, 5, 7, and 77,
yes,
wasn't it?
Yes.
So now we've got 4, and they start with A, obviously, A4, and then V, and then we've got some H's. So vertical and horizontal, of course. A4V, A44H, which is a super interesting form factor, A7V, A77H, and a new one, A8H. Actually, no, it's not really new, because they had the A8X, which never sold that much. Anyway, that A44 is a really interesting shape, because it's designed to be, I think it's a 19-inch rack-ish size. They're definitely not intending you to rack mount this thing, but it's that kind of form factor, of course, horizontal, with dual 4-ish inch drivers. Kind of cool. They've all taken on a bit more of a head audio appearance because they've changed up the waveguide, which, yeah, I think head audio is ex-Adam engineers. Don't quote me on that. I might be wrong, but there's a certain something, similarity. Of course, they're both using an air motion transformer type tweeter, folded ribbon, whatever you want to call it. But with these new Adam ones, you can rotate it to either have the really wide sweet spot, which they like to plaster all over their unique features type list, and then you can flip it the other way to avoid reflections off things like pianos and studio desks and whatnot. Adam McCall, I know you're not a massive fan, I think, of the sound yourself, Pete, but yeah, that's cool.
Well, I think the T-series, which is the budget series, are really good you consider them alongside all the other monitors in that price range.
I certainly sold a lot of them.
They come out head and shoulders above any of the others, the Yamaha HS series, the KRKs, and other ones that I can't think of, Tannoy Golds.
Cali audio ones.
Yeah, they weren't too bad, it was just the reliability.
Reliability was a disaster.
Having said that, going back, the Tannoy Golds are not too shabby either, they're slightly more expensive. But the X series, compared to other things in the same price, didn't really...
They won fewer battles when I was demoing them.
Definitely. I mean, the Genelex always came out top, but they were top money as well.
Yeah, I think most of my victories were... Genelec and Focal stuff, the wooden shape.
The Focal shapes do sound good, they're just a bit strange with the passive radiators.
Yeah, they tend to suffer on absolute bass extension reach, which tends to impress people into buying speakers when they can really feel those lows.
They do have some issues. I had one returned recently where the passive diaphragm hadn't been stuck properly.
Oh, and it gone all flappy.
Yeah, it was farting.
Oh no, disaster. Anyway, Adam, A series, go and check them out. I forgot to mention the A8H is actually a three-way monitor as well, so it's kind of in that the big Neumann shape. I can't remember what model number it is, but that three-way.
Well, it's still cool stuff. Still regarded as near-field speakers, or they're moving into the midfield.
You could argue that the 77 and the 8 would be definitely moving into mid, but I think Adam is saying, yeah, they're near-fields. I think until you jump into their S series, that's when they actually start going, oh yeah, these are probably mids at this point. What do we got? Yeah, probably once you get to the S3V, that would probably start being a mid because they're massive. Anyway, monitors, schmonitors, there you go. I thought that was interesting. And unfortunately, it's the end of what news of the music and technology world I have to bring you. You know what that means? The end of a Rack Addict After Hours episode is the miscellaneous multimedia recommendation. Pete, you've got a piece of paper next to you. Does that mean you're ready?
I am ready.
Ooh, take it away.
Right, I'm not a big proponent of the kind of conspiracy channels.
Where's
on
this
YouTube
going?
You know, the sort of flat earthers, tinfoil hat wearers, etc., etc. But I have come across one which I thought was interesting because of the way it was presented. And it is called The Y Files. And the sort of format that I've witnessed in the past has been the History Channel type of thing, where you know, sort of UFO hunters.
That classic guy with the History Channel with the aliens meme, that dude.
Yeah, that type of thing where they keep showing the same bit of video over and over again and have a few talking heads talking about it. And that. This is different. This is a guy sitting on a set talking to camera with graphics, and it looks like the research is a lot more solid and the graphics that back up a bit more varied. They're not keep repeating or cycling the same bits of video. The one I watched was pertaining to some kind of UFO type thing, but there are many and varied interesting videos. I just thought it was a different slant. I don't take some of it or all of it too seriously, but I think it's worth a watch. So that is my multimedia recommendation for this week, the YouTube channel, The Y Files.
Nice one. I assume that's WHY.
Yes.
Absolutely. Nice one. Well, I had a very long couple of drives to and from Manchester a while ago. I might have mentioned, I don't know if I did, but who cares if I didn't. Most importantly, I was introduced to Mogwai on those journeys. Do you Mogwai? Do you know any Mogwai?
I don't Mogwai.
No, I didn't. But it does support my theory that in slightly off-center, progressive-ish genres of music, the longer songs are the best ones. So I'm going to share with you a 23-minute and 9-second long song. I'm going to play the whole thing for you now. No, of course I'm not. So, the tune that I'm not going to subject you to the entirety of is 23 minutes and 9 seconds long. It's called Music for a Forgotten Future from the album Hardcore Will Never Die, But You Will, in brackets, Music for a Forgotten Future, Mogwai. Yes, I'm not even going to attempt to describe it, but it worked. I think it's something about musicians not worrying about finishing the song in a commercial way, or and just letting it go where it needs to. oftentimes it really works. So go and have a listen. Music for a Forgotten Future by Mogwai. That's it. That's the end of episode 146 of Rack Addicts After Hours. We do hope you tune in again. Thank you so much. Farewell.